a pitch pong where is that a call?
Oh, great.
That looked fun. So do you enjoy doing that?
Yeah, so much fun. Yeah, I loved it.
It really comes through, too. I don't know if you... Yeah, obviously you love film and you have a passion, but I think that's why it works for you. So,
All right. Yeah, I try and like have that come through, and the fact that, you know, I think sometimes these movies can be daunting for people that don't know them to get into, mm-hmm. and I try to make them not so pretentious. It's more like, it's fun, and these are great movies, and here's why you should enjoy them.
And you have great energy, and so I'm pretty low-key. You probably know from the podcast. So, in fact, you might have to wake me up a couple times. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah,
but,
no.
You know, when you're talking about, like, Italian neorealism, it's, you know, I get excited, and I feel excited, but I don't really maybe exhibit it like you do, but you really do emote very well.
So, yeah, good.
You're an art film champion. So, okay, I guess we're on the film, on the show. So this is Alicia Malone. Hey.
Hi.
So I don't know how to introduce you, but so you Filmstruck, TCM, the movie ticket thing?
Fandango.
Fandango.
Fandango as well. I never know what to call myself. I call myself a film reporter, basically. I just get to talk about films and talk to people about films and travel the world going to film festivals. So maybe my correct title should be the luckiest girl in the world.
Yeah, can we switch jobs?
Sure thing.
Just last week I was talking to Jeff about how cool his job is, and I think it's, the jury's out which one's cooler, his or yours, but they're both very, very cool.
Very cool. Yeah, I love Jeff.
Yeah, we had fun talking to him. So it's just us. So usually we just kind of warm up and talk about what we're doing, and this week you had a closet video come out, which was a nice timing. Did you know that was coming out?
No, I had no idea. So I recorded that sort of towards the beginning of summer, and that was such a dream come true, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
I watch all the closet videos religiously. My favorite one is Barry Jenkins, where he fills up his bag. And
yes.
You can see how excited he is to be in the closet. And so I went to Criterion, to their offices, because we're going to have lunch before mm-hmm. this Filmstruck dinner, an event that we had. And so I just said, do you mind if I have a little look around the office? I've never been there before. And Peter Becker was so nice in taking me around, and I got to see, you know, the rooms where they restore the films. And I couldn't say anything at the time, but they were working on Sid and Nancy, which mm-hmm. was really cool to see. They were figuring out showing me the differences in the color that they were trying to restore. And then I went to the audio room where they had just done festival, and talked to the audio engineer who had to track down a live recording of the audio from the festival, the actual concert recording, to try and match it with the film recording, because that was better quality. And it's just amazing the level of painstaking detail and love that these people have for these movies, and trying to restore them as best they can and work with the directors so they're happy with it. So I was so amazed by that. And then I said, oh, can I have a look at the closet? I just want to see what it looks like. I just want to take a picture and put it on Instagram and be like, look at this, guys. And they said, well, you should do a video. And I was like, but isn't that just for like filmmakers and people that have contributed to film? And Peter was like, no, you're a host of Filmstruck. You definitely qualify.
Absolutely.
And we want you to do one. So off you go. And it's so overwhelming when you go in there, because it's stuffed full. It's a tiny space and it's done by spine number. So it's not that easy to find things.
Right.
And I had no plan. I had no idea what I would do. So it was like, and go. And it gave me a bag, and I kept saying, like, are you sure? Are you sure that I can take this?
These are mine?
Like, am I taking too much? Yeah. They were like, no. Take as many as you like. Take as many as you like. And so literally it was just like looking around and then seeing something and going like, I love this movie, and trying to articulate why you love it, putting it in the bag. And the whole process was probably about 20 minutes. And it was kind of like you could keep going until you stopped. But there was a point where I was like, okay, I think I've taken enough. I feel bad.
Well, I guess the bag is the limit, right? So basically you fill the bag and you're done. So
I filled the bag. But then they were like, we could get you another bag. And I said, no, that's fine. Wow. I feel really greedy. And they said, I've got to catch a plane as well. And they said, we can ship them to you. And I said, no, no, these aren't leaving my site. And I walked out with them clasped to my heart. And then I, of course, I was like, I don't know when this video is coming out or if it was good enough to come out, but it was exciting to see it up this week.
And there were some other people in the closet this weekend. And I, boy, I forget their names.
Oh, the Safdie brothers.
That's right. Right. So they were in there and they just, some social media posts, I guess the video probably will be coming in a couple months, but I saw that they and Barry Jenkins were kind of razzing each other for their greed.
That's so cool. Yeah. But, and I heard the guys from the Wolf Pack, they took a lot because I said to Criterion people, I was like, who took the most out of everyone? And there was a couple of people, so I didn't feel so bad. And then the Criterion sale was not long after that. So then I bought another 20 on the sale, so just to make up for it. So I was like, hey.
Nice. Yeah. Well, if you don't mind, I do want to talk to you about your book, which I just finished yesterday. But since we're already on the subject of the closet video, you mind talking about it a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of geek out about these things, and I think you're – well, you can certainly appreciate that, but I loved your choices. In fact, I thought the response was great to your video.
Well, that's good. I haven't read the comments.
Don't read the comments. Never read the comments. But some there are some haters in our community, few. I'd like to think that in – but in the Criterion Cast community, there are fewer, but there are people everywhere that, but I didn't see any hate. I thought, actually the closet video that preceded you, the Aubrey Plaza, and I forget her husband's name, but,
Jeff Bayona.
Yeah. Yeah. They got a little, I think it was unfair because I don't think they really understood what the closet video was like. So, yeah. Or was it supposed to be, but anyway, yours was great. And I saw cause I saw you did your own little video of it and you posted your haul, but, they only showed about like half a dozen or a few more. So anyway, I liked your choices, and I thought it was great that you chose Breaker Moran as your first one. You're Australian, so
yeah.
It was interesting hearing that you saw that movie in class, and it wasn't that special to you. And you probably haven't heard our episode, but my wife actually teaches that film in class, and that's like one of our favorite films. And yeah, Jack Thompson just rocks it, and. So big fan of that film. Are you a fan? I mean, obviously you're from Australia. Do you get into Australian film in general, or is that?
Yeah, I have more of an appreciation for it now I get older. And there's definitely moments in Australian film that I love. The 90s was really great with Australian movies like Muriel's Wedding and The Castle, some great comedy. Oh, yeah. During the 70s and 80s, there was the Ozploitation era where there was suddenly an influx of these really crazy filmmakers like Dr. George Miller, who came out with Mad Max. And I love that period in Australian film because it was so... Peter Weir. It was so creative. And... yeah, when I was at school, we watched Breaker Morant, and at first I was like, oh, this is just kind of a courtroom drama. But as I've gotten older, I definitely have more of an appreciation for it. And same with Walkabout, which was another Australian film that I chose from the closet. And that was one I saw when I was young, and it's such a disturbing film, and it paints such a dystopian view of the outback that at the first time I saw it, I didn't really enjoy it. But now that I've watched it more and more, now I'm older, I have an appreciation for the art of the filmmaking with it. And they didn't show on the video, but I also took Picnic at Hanging Rock and a few other Aussie ones. I got to have it in my collection.
Love Picnic. Again, quotes love. not an easy movie, but Walkabout. I actually have only seen half because my disc broke. I meant to bring it by there, but I forgot. I left it at my hotel. And you also picked Eraserhead, which is very timely.
Very timely.
Into Twin Peaks or?
Yes, into Twin Peaks and into all David Lynch. And that was one of the first films I saw, which really just exploded my mind of what film could be. I mean, I wasn't sure what to make of it when I first saw it. Mm. It was a bit disturbing, but I couldn't get it out of my head. And it was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. And I know that's what many people experience when they watch David Lynch. And that really opened the gates to explore more art house films. I saw it when I was a teenager. And so I was like, I have to get this one.
Nice. That's a nice gateway. Yeah. It's weird that that's a gateway for so many people because I've seen it. I saw it after I was an art film fan. And so I just saw a chicken in a radiator.
but that wasn't
even my first David Lynch, but I've come to appreciate it, but at first it took me a while. And you pick some Asian films, Akiru and Lady Snowblood, which you can't really compare, but from the same country, but I used to have that DVD too, the Akiru DVD, and it was like this big brick of a DVD, which I was actually glad when they upgraded, so I had a little more room.
Me too. That was the first one I got, the first Criterion ever to add to my collection when I was back in Australia. So I felt like it was full circle to take it again from the closet.
Nice. It was one of my first too. And let's see, you had some Godard, you had Weekend, which I actually love Weekend. Just the cars.
Me too.
And the radicalism. I think it's almost his more unrestrained film. Full on. I'm a tough critic on Godard, one of my film professors said that hating Godard is getting Godard, so I'm getting Godard.
That's so true. I took Breathless as well, just to have, you know, in my collection. And but Weekend, again, one of those films that you can't get out of your mind once you see it.
Yeah.
I love what it's talking about with consumerism and how it makes you feel like you're in a traffic jam. And it's so influential. I mean, I've seen the long tracking shots done time and time again after seeing Weekend.
Oh, that's such a great shot. Yeah.
A great shot.
The one down with the cars. The one with the cars. That narrows it down. One going down the street. That's a great shot. And then Gilda, which I think we'll talk about when we talk about your book. But Rita Hayworth, a tough story. Having just read your book, I mean, I knew about it, but, just close to home, but I do love Gilda. And and then His Girl Friday. And I think I'm sure there's some others you took that didn't make the final cut.
I took a bunch of others. It's all kind of a blur now, but I took 21 in total. So I'm glad that they cut it down, because otherwise it would have been a very long video.
That would have been awesome. So, and in fact, you posted your own YouTube. So I'll put that in the show notes for people to watch your, it was very meta, but your video blog of your experience. So, do you want to talk about just Alicia, how your background, how you, I know you said you came to the country in 2011, I think. So, now you're so entrenched in the film world and the art film world. So how did this start?
My love for film started when I was really young. My dad was a huge classic film buff, and he introduced me to a lot of Hitchcock and Kubrick films when I was young. And then my mom loved movies as well. And through my teenage years, I really made an effort to read a lot of film history books and see a lot of films. I'd go to the video store every week and get the 7 films for 7 days for $7 and make sure I would comb through the independent section, the classic section, the art section, and the foreign section. And then after school, I moved from Canberra straight to Sydney with no plan of going to university. And by that stage, I decided I didn't want to work in film. It seemed like it was just too tough to be a film director, especially for women, because I'd read a lot of film history books and they'd never mentioned many women. In Australia, obviously, we had Gillian Armstrong and Jane Campion to look to.
Right.
But there were so few in all the films that I watched. So I thought it seems too tricky, and film seems like a really difficult process. So I decided I wanted to work in television. Mm-hmm. And the first job I got when I moved to Sydney was at a video store, and I loved it. And I would recommend, videos to people and watch as many as I could and try to learn as much as I could. And then I got a job in television behind the scenes. And the first job I got was operating the teleprompter. Huh. Which has now come really handy, being in front of the teleprompter, because I know how to read from the teleprompter. It's quite tricky. So I started out doing that, getting coffee for people, photocopying scripts, and that was at Channel 7 in Sydney.
Cool.
They did a morning television show, much like today's show, called Sunrise, which they still do today. And so my shift would start at 4 a.m., and I would go from 4 a.m. to 9 a.m., and then I went to a production course that I was doing, just a very general television production course, just to do something all day and then go to sleep and do it all again. But I really loved it. So I worked at Channel 7 for 6 years. Wow. And then I saw a job advertised for Movie Network, which was a group of movie channels on cable. And they were looking for a producer editor. And I knew how to produce, didn't know how to edit, but I just pretended that I did. I was like, yeah, totally.
Works for a lot of people.
Edit, you know.
Why not?
And then that interview was on the Friday. And they said, okay, do you want to come back on Monday for a second round of interviews? So then that weekend, I taught myself Final Cut Pro.
Nice.
I'll figure it out. Got that job. So I started writing, producing, and editing little TV shows that went in between the movies on the channels. And I loved it because they had one channel that was new releases, one channel that was independent films, and one channel that was classics. So I got a great range of films. And then I decided it looked really fun to be a host, and you get to go and talk to people about films and get to, you know, do all these great stuff. So I started pitching show ideas that they would do that wouldn't cost them any more money, that I could produce and edit, and I could host them as well. And eventually they relented and they let me do that. So from there, I started doing red carpets and junkets and going on morning television shows, doing reviews and writing reviews for film magazines. And then gave that all up at the end of 2010 to come over here to LA because I wanted to be amongst it all in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anyone and I had no work lined up, but I just had a feeling that it would all work out. Yeah, just my two suitcases. I was like, I'm here.
You're Mulholland Drive. Well, not quite. Maybe.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. It felt kind of sort of the beginning of Mulholland Drive.
Maybe yeah. The very, very, very beginning. Yeah. And so now you work for, how many companies?
A couple now. Yeah. So I work for, well, basically just two these days, Filmstruck and Fandango.
Okay.
And Filmstruck was, again, a dream come true where when I moved over and I didn't know many people, I would just stay at home and watch TCM. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have TCM in Australia, so I started watching it. And I would see Robert Osborne and Ben Mankiewicz. And we had a guy in Australia called Bill Collins who he introduced the late night classic movies. And I always used to record his intros because I loved hearing them. So I got out my little goal book when I first moved here and I wrote, one day I want to work with TCM. And I didn't know how that would happen. But now I feel so fortunate that not only do I work with TCM, but I also work with Criterion, who I've always loved and appreciated. And it's probably even more suited to me personally that I get to talk about foreign films and art house films and independent films. And for Fandango, I do a show weekly called Fandango Indie Movie Guide, where I get to talk about the tiny little films and hope that people will go to see them based on my recommendations.
Okay, well, there are a lot of those. I haven't seen that, I'm sorry, but I've seen a lot of the Filmstruck stuff. And I love your little Filmstruck Fridays. Quibble is I think they should put Filmstruck Fridays on Filmstruck.
Well, they tried that.
Oh,
they
okay.
did for about 2 weeks. They put it on the new section called F-Stop. And then they did some market research, which apparently didn't like my Filmstruck Friday. It's different in tone. But really, I do them, you know, for my YouTube channel to try to, you know, make these films feel more accessible and give you some solid recommendations, because I think it can be daunting if you look at the Criterion Collection or if you go onto Filmstruck just to where to start, because there's so much on there.
By the way, you are our first actual YouTuber on this on any podcast.
Hey.
Well, we probably had some people that have dabbled, but you're not our first Australian, so sorry.
Oh, who else did you have?
We have this gentleman named Tim Lego, who he still lives there, and scheduling, as you know, it's on the other side of the planet. Pretty tough. Yeah. I think we had to either schedule in the future or the past. So
yeah,
the next day or the next night. But yeah, he owns, I think, all the Criterion, all Arrow, good, big film enthusiast. So would you, as far as your tastes go, would you say, I could tell they run the gamut. You like you said, indie film, you like art film, you like Australian film, Japanese film, but do you have any taste? I think from your book, it seems like maybe classic Hollywood is your bread and butter. Is there anything in particular, any directors you that really hit your sweet spot?
Yeah, directors, probably Alfred Hitchcock. He's my favorite director of all time. And I, you know, again, that can be conflicting when you talk about women in film, particularly, you know, mm-hmm. Tippi Hedren. But just in terms of the films that I watch time and time again, and I always discover more every time I watch his movies. He was so clever. And I love the way that I just saw the documentary or the end of last year, Hitchcock Truffaut.
Yeah, I've seen that. Very good. Yeah.
Based on the book. Yeah, it's yeah. great. And
book's
I love
good
that
too.
Story. Yeah, I love that story of how, because I had the book and I love the documentary about how Truffaut was really instrumental in making people aware of the art of mm-hmm. Hitchcock, because I think it can be really easy to see his films and just see them as simple horror films or simple thrillers, but there's so much going on when you break it down frame by frame. So Hitchcock remains special to me because he was one of the first people that I realized, you know, when I watched a film when I was young and like, oh, someone made this. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have that first realization that movies don't disappear, it's like, oh, this is a person that's making this and they're trying to say something with this movie. And, oh, okay, if I break down every shot, okay, this is what he means by this and this makes you feel this way. And so he was the first director to do that. So he probably is my favorite because of that.
Okay. I'm trying to think of how he treated his female characters. And I guess he sometimes had some strong female characters, sometimes not, maybe.
I know. There's a debate about the Hitchcock blonde, and I think it's really interesting when you can look at that as being that he sort of created these characters that were interchangeable from each other. He, you know, had a particular fetish for blondes. Mm-hmm. Or you could look at it as that's what he was trying to do, was to take something that is iconic like a blonde and some, you know, kind of an innocence of a blonde mm-hmm. and then twist that on their heads, because the blonde usually had something to hide. The blondes were unnatural blondes. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an artifice, a mask that they were already wearing. I think that's a more interesting way to look at it.
Interesting. Yeah. His British films, you don't think of the platinum blondes as being so prominent.
Yeah.
So maybe that was just his critique of Hollywood.
I think so.
Or it might have been him just trying to sell a movie too. So, maybe a little of both. But really exciting time for you. Of course, you just released your book, Backwards and in Heels, which is basically, I believe the subtitle was the past, present, and future of women in Hollywood, was it?
Film? Yeah, women in film, but I did just focus on Hollywood.
Yeah, mostly. And I guess we'll kind of touch on some of that too. But as I mentioned, I just finished it yesterday, and I didn't know what to expect. You know, it's actually really my first female filmmaker book. I've taken a women's studies class, so that counts for something. So some of that stuff was not foreign to me. It was actually a really interesting class. But so basically, you have a structure where it is the past, the present, and then the future. However, I think I didn't count it, but I think the vast majority is the past. Probably about 2/3, and then a little bit about modern times, and then a short bit about the future.
Really tiny, yeah.
Well, you know, we're not Nostradamus here, but I like that you have the structure is basically anecdotes. You kind of point this out at the very beginning. You can read them a little bit at a time, or you can read it cover to cover. I've read it cover to cover, and it flowed very well. But I guess people could skip around if they so chose. But so obviously, it took you a while to write this, probably a year or two, or
no, I had 5 months.
Wow,
I had 5 months where I had to write and research at the same time. So that was a lot to do in a short amount of time. And when I first got approached by the book publisher, you know, I had this idea and I wanted to do something on the history of women in Hollywood, because like I said earlier, when I read a lot of film history books, I hadn't come across many stories about women in Hollywood. And then I had, apart from like the big stars, And then, you know, I'd read a couple of female filmmaker books, and they were really, I mean, amazingly well written by professors who know way more than I ever could, but they were quite academic and sometimes hard to get through. They were more like textbooks. So I wanted to do something, again, that would be accessible for people who might not know anything about film and give something interesting for people who might know a lot about film and do just essentially a guidebook, an introduction. So it's not a comprehensive history, but it just gives you an overview of the history of women in film. And one thing that really set me on the path to wanting to explore this was coming across a statistic that said that at the start of American cinema, there were more opportunities for women in Hollywood than there are today. And I was like, how can that be? That was before women even had the right to vote. But it's crazy. But it was so interesting to delve into that. And I actually wrote the whole first draft, and I wrote it just very chronologically and ended up thinking, okay, this is really boring because it's just a list of facts. So that's when I decided to break it down into stories and just pick a couple of different stories per era to focus on. And hopefully each of these stories illustrates a problem or an obstacle that women face in Hollywood.
Yeah, and I think it's also a way for audiences to be familiar, like, say, Hattie McDaniel. You know, a lot of people have seen Gone with the Wind, whereas I'm sure you could have found a lot of obscure, and some you did cover some obscure. Alice, is it Gache as somebody that is well-known? I'm sorry, well-known in our circles. Of course, I just mispronounced her name, but, but you know, the average filmgoer probably wouldn't even know she exists. But yeah, I like that you didn't, well, obviously in 5 months, you're not going to do an academic sketch of women filmmakers. But I think that as somebody that knows film reading it, I could tell that there were some things you kind of, you know, explained at a high level, but it was still interesting. I think you went into depth when it was necessary, especially in the modern stuff. A lot of that was really, revealing. What I really liked about it is you use, well, not always, but often you would use first person and you would give your own opinions, just in chapters, which I thought, you know, it's not a first person narrative, but, I think I like that you, you know.
Okay, cool. I wasn't sure about that. That was something I went back and forth on because for a while there I was making everything quite personal. And then I thought, no, it's not about you, Alicia. It's about these amazing women. And so I tried to keep myself out of it, especially when you're talking about women of color. And of course, being a white girl from Australia, I don't want to pretend I have that experience. So I definitely just wanted to distance myself and my opinion a bit and just give the facts. But then at moments that I felt, you know, very connected to it, like Marilyn Monroe's story or as we get into the modern day stuff, I really wanted to give my personal taste in it. So I'm glad you like those little touches.
I thought it was funny how you did not write your bio in the first person. I'll leave that for people to read it, but that's a little cute way to finish the book.
It's always weird to write your own bio.
Yeah, I did this and this and this.
Yeah, I'm so great.
But you don't, it's not just female filmmakers. As I just mentioned, Hattie McDaniel, there's actresses, there's editors, there's cinematographers, screenwriters, really the entire gamut. And I really found that it's not just about, I mean, it isn't about females, but I think just by using this subject, you kind of cover really diversity in film or the lack thereof in a lot of cases, especially from, you know, 30 to, well, till 2017, unfortunately. But
yeah, I know. Yeah, I really wanted to be as inclusive as possible and make sure I touched on issues of diversity and issues of, you know, lack of LGBTQ representation.
Right. Maya Taylor.
How important it is. Yeah, Maya Taylor from Tangerine. I got to speak with her and she was so wonderful. And it's such a shame that, you know, she was so brilliant in Tangerine, exploded on screen. And afterwards, you know, she went through the whole award season, she got taken around to all these fancy premieres, and then nothing. And it's such a shame. And also the fact that she only ever gets offered roles as, you know, transgender prostitutes.
It's terrible.
I just want to see, she's like, I just want to play a woman, you know, and I think that's really sad. But hopefully, I mean, the thing that I was surprised when I started writing the book was firstly, I thought I was going to be really depressed at the end because yeah. you do write these things and you see history repeating itself, especially when it comes to diversity. And then you're frustrated by this. But talking to all these people, talking to people like Dr. Stacey L. Smith, who does all the great research into mm-hmm. the statistics of women working in film, Gina Davis,
who has her
institute, Ava DuVernay, mm-hmm. and then J.J. Abrams and Paul Feig. These people really working hard to try to change the industry from the inside. I mean, that mm-hmm. gave me so much optimism because they all have optimism. And if they're so optimistic about it and they know the industry better than I do, then by the end, I felt like, oh, this can change and it will change. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah, yeah. And I work for a company. I'm a corporate guy. People probably know that. But I work for a company who actually I'm very proud of the fact they strive to have executives 50-50. I think they're not quite there yet, but they're pretty close. I think I haven't measured, but probably 40-60, which, you know, for a public company, that's a Fortune 500 company.
Great.
That's pretty amazing. So I really, as a white guy, you know, a white guy that works for corporate America, I did identify with Paul Feig and J.J. Abrams. Not that I have anything, or I have some things in common, but not the same talents. But it was nice to see that it's not just, you know, it's even though Gina Davis is very powerful and she can speak from a position of power and credibility, it's nice that there are, you know, it's not all. Well, we had a feminist on the show once that said, not all men. And so it's nice to see that. So,
Especially because they're the ones that often have the most power. So mm-hmm. if they can really make a difference, and that helps so much.
Yeah. And it makes, and I have a good friend who is very, this is a cause she takes very, very close to heart. And she will go to the opening weekend of any female directed movie. No matter what it is, it can be terrible. And sometimes it is terrible. That's the way things go. She saw Wonder Woman opening night and wasn't crazy about it. I know a lot of people loved it. And I think that's good for the culture. I still haven't seen it, so I don't know if it's any good. people I respect say mixed things,
It's not a perfect film, but I felt surprisingly emotional watching it, which mm-hmm. I don't normally enjoy the superhero movies just because I feel like there's often not a level of stakes to them. I know that Thor's going to return again, so I'm not really worried about him, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm not naturally into the kind of big action. But I was so surprised at how empowered I felt to see a woman on screen who was strong, and also not just strong in a masculine sense of strong, mm-hmm. but strong in a very feminine way too. And she wasn't sexualized, she wasn't objectified. And it really felt like, whoa, this is cool. This is what it feels like to see yourself as a superhero on screen.
And I'm pretty optimistic about the Captain Marvel too, because I think Brie Larson, just her mentality, I think she will bring a lot of credibility to the role. But one thing, especially the modern parts of your book, I think that we've made strides, but mm-hmm. sometimes you think that and then people get comfortable, and I think we've seen that in the stories of people. Okay, well, I made strides, Maya Taylor got an indie spirit and then didn't get any roles. And I hope that they don't think, okay, well, you know, this was very successful, but, you know, let's.
Yeah. And I've seen that already. I've seen some articles of being like, it's the summer of women because Wonder Woman did really well. And it's like, whoa, wait, not just yet. Because that's what Gina Davis talks about in my book, about how after Thelma and Louise, everyone was like, hey, everything's changed now. And then after League of Their Own, they were like, now there's going to be so many female sports movies. And then with Paul Feig, after Bridesmaids, it's like, yay, women raunchy comedies do really well. But then that's it. And nothing happens after that. No real change. But mm-hmm. I do think there's such a level of conversation now, and particularly with social media being so prevalent
in the last
decade or so, that it's going to be really hard for them to get away with the same things now, because people just call it out. You know, you saw that with Ghost in the Shell. People were like,
I'm
not going to see that film
people
because
will
of that.
Vote for with their dollars, not just going to see female filmmakers, but if they see something is that, you know, I hate to get into controversies. Well, I'm not going to even touch on the controversy, but there was one controversy where there was a promising film and then some controversy happened and people chose not to see that film. So, mm-hmm. And I'm one of them. So, anyway.
I think people can make their decisions now, but you have social media that is able to call things out for you. And even like sometimes I'll see a film and I'll get caught up with the festival buzz of it. Mm-hmm. And then someone will come out with something on Twitter or an article where they say, hey, actually, this wasn't a great representation, you know, of this character. And I'll be like, oh, yeah, you're right. I didn't notice till you pointed that out. And now mm-hmm. I totally understand.
I can learn always. Like I was just thinking, trying to think back about Hitchcock, you know, trying to think about how he portrayed people. I think there are some male directors that do portray women very well. We talked about this on another show. I think Bergman is one of them. But yes. Bergman was not a saint to his women. They were very loyal, but, you know, he was a taskmaster sometimes. So
yeah, I know it's a tricky situation, but I love Persona. I think that one,
me too,
really is a great film for women.
And I don't know if you've noticed the podcast logo is Persona. So
yes.
I'm very
love
proud
it.
Of that. So thank you. So actually that's a good transition. So, I hope your book's doing well. Is it doing well or is it too early to tell?
I think so. Okay. Yeah, I think it's doing well. I love seeing everybody on social media sending me pictures of themselves with the book or just a picture of the book, and mm-hmm. everyone seems excited. I've heard from the publishers that it's doing really well. And then one of my friends went into a bookstore where I had a signing recently. And I know for the signing, they bought a whole stack. I think they bought like 50 books. And the signing went really well. I was worried no one was going to show up, but everyone was there and signed a lot of books. And then my friend went into the bookstore to buy one and they were all sold out. So I was like, okay, I think that's a good sign.
Well, you can call this guy. He has 50. They're probably on eBay now. I'm kidding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, probably. It's probably all my... I said, I'm going to sign your name so that you can't sell it again.
There you go. Well, congratulations. That's exciting. I was in the book industry once and it is crazy.
It
is very crazy, but, and I also had 5 months. So, but
but
one thing, and you mentioned that your book focused on Hollywood mostly. I'd say probably 90 mm-hmm. something percent. But and I was trying to find the article, but I remembered there being an article that said that that foreign filmmakers had a lot more female foreign filmmakers had a lot more opportunity. And, you know, just anecdotally, I think of some of my favorites. And you mentioned Jane Campion. I think of Agnes Varda. A lot of people that are in the collection.
Chantal Ackerman.
Ackerman, yeah. Whereas classic Hollywood, maybe during the 30s to 60s, there weren't so many. Well, actually, and not that this is a great thing, but Leni Riefenstahl, you know.
Yeah, I know. Well, she was very influential.
She was, yeah.
And you can't deny that.
Horrific regime, but they at least gave females the camera. So I shouldn't make light of that.
Exactly.
Save the hate mail, folks.
It's true that at foreign film often offered more opportunities for women. And I think that's reflected when you look at Criterion Collection. And I also know that they are really mindful of wanting to include more female filmmakers in the collection and also having more women doing closet videos. That's something that they really want to do because it can be very male dominated, even the Criterion fans, you know, and they really want to encourage more women. And same with Filmstruck, you know, we really want to get more female viewers watching because they're out there, you know, they really are.
Good point about Criterion fans. I was looking at we have a Facebook group and our statistics, we are 93% male. So,
oh, wow.
And I don't think, I think it's a very tolerant and very, a very positive male. You don't see any of the junk you see elsewhere, but, I think that just that males tend to gravitate towards art films. My wife doesn't watch half the films with me. So,
And I think also with the collecting as well, like the Criterion Collection,
it's a hobby.
I think that can, it's a hobby. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing this hobby with us. But, did you see, it was a year or two ago, Criterion was called out for not, do you remember this or were you aware?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, I remember seeing that.
And I thought it was a little unfair because, and I think your book illustrates this, that there really just wasn't, you know, you can't just go create female filmmakers in classic Hollywood. There was really only one
exactly
in the sound era. But I think that they have made, so I think that was unfair. But I did like that Peter responded to it and took it to heart. And I think that, that they've made some efforts to include female film. And I think they always have. I think maybe just people are noticing it since then, or maybe we are noticing it.
Yeah, I think they definitely have, and that's something that Peter's mentioned to me as well, saying like that's what something that they're really mindful of doing. It's one of these things, like you say, if there wasn't many female filmmakers around, then you can't just create it. And also it's a thing of lack of opportunity meeting lack of films out there. So you don't want to include
lack
something just – yeah, you don't want to include something just for a token reason. You know, you do want to uphold the idea of the Criterion Collection. But they've been great about trying to include more, and there are certainly – very well qualified female filmmakers out there that can do it. And recently, well, the event that I was there in New York for with Filmstruck was Kirsten Johnson with Camera Person.
Isn't that
great? And I love that they include that in the Criterion Collection, and they really supported that. It was great.
And that's a cinematographer that's been nominated for. Wait, no, she didn't get nominated.
There's never been a female cinematographer nominated for an Oscar, which is crazy.
It wouldn't have been that category, but still, I love Camera Person, and it's still a minority of the works. You can't, like you said, you have to keep the credibility of the label intact. But I think also with Classic Hollywood, they put out Gilda. I guess that. I don't know if that I'd call that a feminist film, but they put out the Hepburns, and they put out Mildred Pierce. I think is, you know, some strong female, as you put it in the book, women's pictures that kind of walk the tightrope between film art and film commerce. So, and they have some coming up. Certain Women, The Lure, and Desert Hearts are three big female filmmakers that are coming. So I haven't seen any of those three, but I'm excited for all of them.
And I've seen Certain Women by Kelly Reichardt, and that's really great. Tells three different interesting stories about female characters who you don't normally see on screen, and it was very emotionally affecting too. So I'm really happy that that's going to be part of the collection.
Cool. I can't wait. I've seen some other Reichardt, but I have not seen this one. That's because I'm lazy and I wait for my home media, but it took a while for this one. So Well, do you want to geek out a little bit on some Criterion stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, she's smiling, so that's a good thing. So I was going to talk about film Twitter. Well, I guess we can touch on it. I know you hosted a panel at Comic-Con, and there were some female film Twitter people that are pretty cool.
Yes.
How'd that go?
Yeah, it went really well. I mean, there wasn't many people there. So firstly, I think Comic-Con, you know, it was at the same time as the Game of Thrones panel. So that's one thing.
That's a bad draw, yeah.
Away from the convention center, so sort of harder to get people there. But the women that I got involved were so fantastic, and it was a really great buzz between us that we all were saying afterwards of like, how can we work together and help to amplify new voices? Because film Twitter, as you know, is like, it's not necessarily a group per se, but it's just a collection of people who all love talking about film. Mm-hmm. And that can also be a very male-dominated space, and it can be hard for women to want to have their opinions. You know, as happens a lot on the internet, a woman online can get the most attacks for their opinions. Hmm. So it can be difficult. And what I love about the film industry, the industry that I work in, is the fact that there are less women, but because of that, and because, you know, we're supposed to compete with each other, we purposely don't, and we all come together and we're so supportive of each other. We always are talking and trying to like help each other and get jobs for each other and trying to get new women into the space as well. And so I wanted to have a panel where I got my favorite women on film Twitter to come together and talk about the various issues facing women in film and female film critics, and how do we help the next generation of female writers get in the door. And it was wonderful. The girls were so great and such a good time. And then we had a bit of media coverage from it as well. So I was really excited to see that.
That's awesome. Yeah. Actually, Ryan,
I think I'll do it again.
Ryan from Criterion Cast was there. Did you see him?
Yay.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So he purposely meant to make that because I, you know, Game of Thrones, who is not into that, but it's not Hall H, but it should be maybe one day.
Yeah. One day.
So anyway, Criterion Collection. So we had, just a couple. It's been a kind of a dry week. Nothing's coming out this week, but we had La Poison and Sid and Nancy. I don't know if you know this, but we talked to Alex Cox about Sid and Nancy. Was it last year or about a lot of things? But I don't think this was known at the time. But he was very, very thrilled with the DVD version of Sid and Nancy. So I'm sure he's thrilled with the Blu-ray in his shack in Oregon. And then we have a break, and then I think the next one is Rebecca. So speaking of Hitchcock and speaking of female characters, some good, some bad. So that's coming out the beginning of September, September 5th, I think, or 6th. So there's really not a whole lot of fun, geeky news this week. So you got to get off free. There was a New York Film Festival. There were some revival screenings, and so there was some Tarkovsky, some Jean Vigo. Are you into the slow art film cinema, like Tarkovsky?
Yes. Well, I love Stalker, and I was so excited to get that one, get the new restoration from Criterion of Stalker. And then I also love the fact that at the New York Film Festival, they're doing Agnes Varda, too.
Yes, and so, they have her latest, and she was asleep on the Criterion couch a few months ago, so I'm hoping that means something.
She's cute. Awesome. So I saw her in Cannes. She's so tiny.
She is
so sweet.
Petite.
And I love her hair.
En petit fille.
And en petit fille. And I saw her new one, Faces Places. And it's such a great documentary with her and JR, the photographer. Mm-hmm. They have such a wonderful relationship together. And that was a real treat to see. And I'm glad that she's still doing art. She's amazing.
She's getting up there. But her narrative films are fantastic. But I think people sleep on her documentaries. They're really, really strong. Unfortunately, Criterion put out a clip set of those a couple years ago. But there were some new in the restorations that looked like they could come out. Let's see, The Crucified Lovers, which is Mizoguchi. I've seen that one. It's amazing, but I think it's not out really anywhere. I think it might be out in the UK, but and also Sancho the Bailiff, which is also on Criterion already. So you're going to go to the fest, or are you going to TIFF? Or
I'm hoping to. I'm going to TIFF and Telluride.
Sweet.
So okay. Telluride is next week and then TIFF after that. But I really want to do some stuff with I'd love to see some stuff on the New York Film Festival, particularly these restorations, because it's such a rare experience that you get to see these films on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
Like Jean Vigo's La Talante. I can never say that. La Talante.
La Talante.
I've never seen that one on the big screen. I've only seen that on the small screen at home.
Beautiful movie.
So that would be a real treat. Beautiful.
Yeah, I guess I don't think TIFF does a classics lineup, but just Cannes, Venice, and New York. I'm sure there are plenty others, but those are the big ones. I know The Crime of Monsieur Lang is by Jean Renoir. That's a great film that's playing, and I'm hoping that might one day come to the collection. And I think there's probably some others, but
and I love Jean-Pierre Melville, so I love all his films, so they're doing one of his Bob le Flambeur.
I think that one's out of print.
I've never seen that one.
Oh, it's good. That's early. I think that's his first, I think. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Not his first. That's his first gangster film. He did. I can't remember.
But I love Le Samurai and Flick.
Which was just announced, Le Samurai. So we also had some fandom pages, and I don't know if you get into the little Nancy Drew, us trying to piece
it. No, I don't know too much about them.
You probably know some of the secrets, so don't share those. I know some secrets too, but I can't share them. But so we have fandom pages that came up. So there's William. So these are just accidents that people have sleuthed out. It's just a page on Criterion's website that has nothing, and people on the internet will find them and share them, and then they'll talk about what they could be. And actually, often they do turn out to be releases. That big Olympic box set, they found a lot of those from there, and they thought, why are all these Olympic directors showing up on Criterion? Well, now we know. But William Wyler was on there, and that could be, you know, dozens of films. I'd be happy with, I think, anything. Howard Hughes is on there, which is a little strange. I think it could be maybe Hell's Angels. Because I think
that would be the only one I could imagine.
I don't think they put producers on there, because I think he's produced films that are already there. And the other one he directed was not good. I forget the name. It was later. And then Jack Arnold, who yes. is interesting. He's done a lot of B movies, a lot of TV.
Yeah, I have a poster in my bedroom for Tarantula.
Oh, nice, I nice. I think, again, you talk about Criterion worthy. My guess is this is probably The Incredible Shrinking Man.
Oh, Incredible Shrinking Man, yeah.
Just because that one.
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Could be. I guess since they're probably going to be doing Night of the Living Dead, but I think it's possibly,
Incredible Shrinking Man.
That just came out in England too. Are you region free, or do you buy many discs? Or
now I buy Blu-ray. So I had a whole bunch in Australia that were region free, and I had a huge collection. But then when I came over to America, I had to only just bring the bare minimum. So I sold everything so that I would have some money to come here. And now. Now I've just been rebuilding them again, but I go for Blu-rays or the region-free DVDs.
Cool. Well, I know you have about 40 or 50, so that's a big chunk.
Yeah, about 50, yeah.
All right. Well, that's really it for the news stuff, and I'll leave it up to you. We have a little segment usually called Short Takes where we just briefly talk mm-hmm. about a criterion we've seen. Do you want to do this or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. What do you got?
Well, I've been watching a whole bunch, a lot of Jacques Tati films, but then I also have just been watching a lot of films, the first films from great directors. So rewatch Blood Simple, which I've seen so many times, mm-hmm. but every time I love to see how intricate the plot is and how those misunderstandings just work so well. But the one that I'd love to talk about is Cronus by Guillermo del Toro, rewatched, and I hadn't seen it for so long, mm-hmm. But I rewatched it recently. And firstly, it strikes you just how perfect this is as a first film from him. He's got Shape of Water, which is coming out in Toronto. And he's obviously had such a legacy of fantasy horror movies and magical realism. And you can see all of that in Cronos. I love how weird it is, how dark it is, and how it's almost like a vampire film. You know, mm-hmm. this antique dealer who finds this golden scarab who gives you internal life and have to deal with the consequences of that. And that scene with the blood when he's in the
bathroom. Oh, that's a great scene. Watch. Yeah. We did an episode on that a year or two ago, whenever that set came out, which was great. I think it does have some issues. Of course, it being a first film, and I think there was some funding issues mm-hmm. that sometimes that shows in the final the final product. But I think it's a strong debut. Well, mine is actually Meantime by Mike Lee, which just came out. Actually, was it this past week or the week before? I think it was the week before. But so somebody in our community. Kind of called me out for being a little critical of British TV directors. And I don't remember, I don't think I said that, but sometimes I say things and it might seem dismissive, but I think I maybe wasn't excited about it because this was really his pre-theatrical. But I actually am a huge fan of British TV. And I think British, like BBC, has a culture of putting out very, very high quality TV movies. Yeah. You know, Alan Clark, Ken Loach, and Mike Lee, and there's many more. America, not so much. but
it's a different thing, yeah.
It's a different thing, yes. So, there were some bad ones in the 80s and 90s. So Meantime was, I thought it was very, very good. And I compared it to I saw comparisons with some of the other 80s films. I think it's very critical of Thatcherism. I found myself thinking of my Beautiful Laundrette, not just because there's
– me
too, yeah. But not there's also laundry in the film, but it's more just the kind of the cultural – or not really the cultural, but the social, economic side. And that's one thing about British TV is I think they're good at portraying like really gritty realism, which probably really comes out of their kitchen sink movement. But it's, I think, informed – you know, the film through the 80s, 90s, and today. Ken Loach is a great example. He is.
Yeah, Ken Loach just won the Palme d'Or last year.
Yes, and I need to watch that. I have it sitting upstairs. Is it good?
Yes, it's pretty good. I didn't think it was the strongest of his films, but it, once again, like you said, is talking about gritty realism, poverty in modern day England. And it's pretty heartbreaking. I thought times it's a little bit emotionally manipulative because it's like really, really goes for the heartstrings. You're like, everything is bad. But it is a very well-made film and it definitely does open your eyes to issues that are still going on in England.
I would say he's not shy about pulling on the heartstrings. I love Kes. Yeah. It's one of my favorite movies. I don't know if you've seen Kes, but just a tad manipulative, and that's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
All right, well, and so we have a segment on Filmstruck, and usually it's we just cover the week's releases. So, but we have the host of Filmstruck, and by the way, I like that they use the word host and use the word actor because I don't like the genderization of those words, like waitress, stewardess. So thank you for that. So we always talk about everything that came out this week, and well, coincidence, you do too. So you, in fact, I'll put your Filmstruck Friday on. I believe you did Tati.
Yes.
Isn't Tati awesome?
Oh my gosh, he's so great. And so for my little Filmstruck Fridays, I try to pick three different films based on a theme, and then I rewatch them. And that's so much fun because I just love to watch all these films again. It's just a treat for me. And to see films back to back as well, is a unique experience. So I picked Monsieur Hulot's Holiday and Mon Oncle and then Playtime. And to see those all in a row, it was like one night. Amazing. I watched them back to back. It was just amazing.
Oh,
it's just such an incredible artist. Yeah, I binge watched. I binge watch all the time. It's my favorite thing. I'll just stay at home and watch four movies in a row.
Get some Chinese food, sure, or whatever.
I'm thinking actually about getting a treadmill to put in my living room because I realize I sit down and I watch 6 hours of films like regularly. And so I should probably do some kind of exercise while I watch them because otherwise I'm just sitting.
Something that Mark and I talk about all the time. You have to keep healthy. So I exercise as I watch films. It's easier to do so with, say, a 70s giallo or a Hitchcock than it is like a Tarkovsky.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you have to. I think Tati would be good exercise material, a 6-hour workout.
Yeah, well, he's very physical himself, so you feel like you should do something while you're watching him.
You could just imitate him and you'd burn like 1,000 calories.
Yes, for sure. He's just incredible when you see the intricate work that goes into his visual gags. I mean, so elaborate, so well choreographed, and obviously no special effects or anything. It's really him doing it, and just the way that he was able to bring back that art of clowning, you know, which we saw with Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton, and bring it into the sound era. And he still continues to influence people today. There's that great filmmaking pair that did Lost in Paris recently. They've done a bunch of films that are very much inspired by the work of Tati, the physical nature of that comedy.
You know, that's actually playing at my local theater right now, and I had not looked at
it.
Well, yeah, if I wasn't at a podcast, I might go.
Yeah.
I might actually go. And one thing I like about him is there are so many gags, and some of them are very obvious, but it really pays off rewatches because there's so much in the frame and there's so much going on that when I watch Playtime, I'll pick up at least a dozen new things. It's terrific. And my wife even likes him, but for Mon Oncle, she now wants a house like Villa Arpel, so I think she completely missed the point.
I want the house like Hulot's house. Yeah,
me
just
too.
And that really speaks to me because I always feel sort of caught between, you know, my love of classic film and wanting to have more of a traditional, simple life with all the modern day stuff that we have now.
Absolutely. That's very, very Hulu. So he was director of the week, Jacques Tati, as you mentioned in your little Filmstruck Friday. Not many films. I think there was only 7, but they're all pretty consistent. I would say Traffic and Holiday are. It's tough to compete with the big three, but they're still worth watching. And there was another segment called Coming to America that had about 10 films. I noticed you did the intros to that. So was that teleprompter or was that memorized?
Yeah, it's all teleprompter, but they have a team of writers and researchers who write all the scripts, but then I get sent the scripts and I go through them to make them in my own words, and I do my own research, and I try to watch as many of those films as I can so that I can really deliver them with some sense of authority. And I think that theme is so perfect, particularly right now, where in America there's such a talk about immigration and immigrants and wanting to keep people out of America. And when you watch something like America, America by Elia Kazan, which is
that.
A very personal story from him. Yeah, it tells basically his uncle's story of coming from Greece to America. And you see the kind of struggle that people go through just to get here with just that vague hope that there will be a better life for them here. Mm-hmm. And then the way that they have contributed to creating America and giving so much to the country. I think it's really important that people watch these films now. I mean, there's so many on there and there's such great movies. And the thing that strikes you all the time is just how much they had to give up in order to come to America.
Yeah, and there's El Norte, so very, very timely.
Yes.
I think that one will be timely for a while. Some of these I haven't seen. I actually haven't seen Sean Baker's Takeout, but that's
Good.
What I need to see.
And Sean Baker has another film, which I just saw in Cannes, called The Florida Project, which is really great, and that looks at the invisible homeless in America. And of course, he had Tangerine as well. So he's always someone that's focused on these stories of people that we don't usually see. We don't usually pay attention to.
We actually just had him on a few weeks ago. Great guy.
Oh, I love him. He's so nice.
He's the best. And he's a huge Criterion fan, too, which is even better. So there's also The Immigrants and the New Land. So wow, this mm-hmm. is. Did you watch all these? This is a lot.
I tried. I watched about five or six of them. And then the others that I couldn't, I tried to watch the trailers or watch mm-hmm. something. I don't get a lot of time in between getting the scripts and shooting the intros. But then I try to just make sure I know something about all the films at least.
Because this is 10 films. It's probably about 30 hours we're talking about here, plus the tattoo. Yeah. And then there's.
And I usually record about 35 intros in a day when I go to Atlanta to film. I was there last week and I shot 66 over 2 days.
Okay.
So I try to see as many as I can, but obviously I can't watch them all.
Okay. Yeah. We're on this side of the country. I forgot TCM Atlanta. I have friends that worked for CNN. So yeah. And there's also early Cirque, and sadly I've seen some early Cirque, but not this era. I've seen some earlier. I've seen his German films, propaganda films. Mm. Did you get to watch any of these?
Yeah, I watched a couple of those, and the thing that struck me is because I always thought of Douglas Sirk as just the very technicolor, the melodramas, and here you see the beginnings of that style, but there's much less of that saturated mm-hmm. color kind of feel to it and much less of the melodrama. So I think it's really interesting that they've chosen to focus on his early work and not necessarily the work that people know the most.
Yeah, I think that's what's great about Filmstruck too, is they shed a shine a spotlight on these films that kind of fall beneath the cracks, like Elia Kazan. You know, we know On the Waterfront. Why am I can't think of Elia Kazan movies, but A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. But we, you know, America, America, and I've made it public. I'm a huge fan of Wild River. I don't think that's on Filmstruck yet, but hopefully one day.
Hopefully.
Do you do much with the Criterion Channel, or do you watch those?
Not a whole lot, but I watch a bunch, and I love the little things that they do. Their regular themes, like the shortened feature mm-hmm. and the Friday double feature, and of course, I always watch the observations on Film Art.
Right, and we just had Jeff on.
So
we had Jeff on Professor Smith, Dr. Smith, last week, but he goes by Jeff, which was easy for me. And he has one on this week, the stripped down style of Ali Feeds the Soul, which we kind of talked about
a
little bit.
Movie.
It is amazing, and he kind of touched on it last week, and the short amount of time that it took. Speaking of Cirque, but he shot this in about 3 weeks, and I've done some research on Fassbender, and he was such a guerrilla filmmaker, like basically, you know, like Kubrick would do 100 takes, but Fassbender would do about 5 maybe, and it's just amazing that he had such a great track record working so fast. He was amazing. But I think this is definitely his high point.
And you can feel that kind of raw quality about it. It feels like immediate and like it's actually happening. And I think because it doesn't appear to be rehearsed.
Right, right. And actually, Jeff pointed out some good criticisms is that some of the dialogue is kind of stilted, but that they're kind of intentionally so to make it kind of a little alien or kind of like World on a Wire, maybe. So, Well, this week's Filmstruck content or the Criterion Channel content, there was the short feature Teeth and then How to Get Ahead in Advertising, big Richard E. Grant duo. Have you seen these?
I'd seen How to Get Ahead in Advertising when I was young, and I haven't seen it again since, so I only have a vague memory of it.
You have nightmares.
But it's one of those films that would play in Australia. Like, we got a lot of the British films. So,
I could see that. And, yeah, probably Heaven and Boyle nightmares. I had not seen it because it's out of print, and it's been out of print for a long time. So I actually jumped on it this week to watch it, and I love Withnall and I is one of my favorite drunk movies.
Me too.
I love Grant. He's so great in that, and he's great in this too. But and actually he's really exceptional. But it's a tough movie. It's about a Boyle that talks and. Anyway, I don't want to spoil it.
It's a nightmarish thing, but I'd love to actually watch it again because I only have vague memories of, again, one of those movies that just stuck in your mind and you can get rid of. You're like, did I dream that movie? Did it actually happen?
there is some art to it. I didn't love it. It's tough to compare with Nolan. I think I couldn't help it, but you know, because it's the year afterward. But I think it was very good, but it's not as charming, I guess. I would say I'll watch it again and piece it apart, but no. one day. Speaking of the Friday double feature, this time it was Kon Ichikawa, who I've seen a good bit from, but I haven't seen these two, and they've both been on my list. Odd Obsession and Actor's Revenge. I hear an Actor's Revenge is very good, but so I have nothing to say, and I guess you don't either.
Yeah, I really have to watch these. It's reminding me how much of a hole I have that I haven't seen either of these movies.
Yeah, he's done some others. The Burmese Harp, Fires on the Plain. Have you seen those?
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
And he did Tokyo Olympiad. So speaking of Olympics, are you excited about the Olympics disc or?
I don't, not so much. No.
Okay.
I mean, I'm intrigued by it, and then I'll watch it because I have never really been that into the idea of the Olympics. So I think it could be a good thing for me to watch.
Well, it's only 60 hours, so
it's easy.
600 hours, excuse me. So yeah, you can just do that.
Can do that.
That's definitely get a treadmill for that. So and of course they do digital spines. So this week we had two new ones. We had Crumb by Terry Zwigoff, and I just talked about that a few weeks ago when we were looking at Ghost World. Good movie, but little creepy. Yeah. Speaking of feminists, he's not he would write the opposite of your book.
Yes, very true.
and I'm not lying. I think he's actually proud of being very, very anti-feminist and sexist. That's just his thing. But it still is a good movie. And then there was Stagecoach by John Ford, which is it's a great movie. But I guess I didn't think about it. There's the Indian.
Yes, I know.
If we think about this too much, we can't enjoy films.
It's quite problematic when you look back on it. It's like I watched Swing Time again recently with Fred Astaire, and I forgot that whole blackface section.
Yeah.
It's just like, wow. I mean, it's obviously a different time, so you have to judge it by that. But same with Stagecoach. You think about it, you're like, oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yes. And a lot of those 30s films especially, that if you see Step and Fetch It and anything, it's –
yeah,
very, very grueling. But even like something like my man Godfrey, and it had a Hispanic. I forget his name. He's great, but you know they wouldn't allow the actual races to play their own races. They had white people playing them. So anyway, So Stagecoach, good movie, a watershed movie. It's John Wayne's breakout. So are you a John Ford fan?
sort of, I mean, I appreciate him more than love. Someone that, you know, it's part of my study of film and obviously created such great, solid movies, but just never been drawn to him in the way that I've been drawn to other directors.
That's fair. Yeah, he's very, yeah, very masculine too, and that's his personality too, and his personality certainly comes through in his films. Very jingoistic, rah-rah.
Very American too.
Very American. So that's it. Doesn't translate overseas. So we had a couple of new films added, or a few that I haven't seen. We had Matrix by Barbette Schroeder. I think it's probably Barbet, which I haven't seen, but I know that he did the couple of Pink Floyd themed films. Mm-hmm. There's The Neighbor's Wife in Mine by Hinosuke Gosho, and I got nothing. And then Rusty Knife by Toshio Masuda. I think I saw that. I actually don't remember. So have you seen any of those three?
No, I haven't seen either of those, any of those.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes it easy through the episode. We just have one thing left that we always do, and that's called our piece of flair. So, is there anything you're interested in that's not Filmstruck or Criterion that you're just into?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned before, I'm about to go to the Telluride Film Festivals and the Toronto International Film Festival. So I'm really excited about both of those. The great thing about Telluride is that they don't announce their slate until the day it starts.
Nice.
Which is kind of exciting, and it adds a real level of secrecy to it. It's also a really great festival because there's no red carpets, there's no press interviews, there's no press badges even. So if you go, you've got to pay full price. And it's really about a celebration of film. The directors who go can always are able to relax, and they're able to just be, and there's no paparazzi and there's nothing that they have to do. And it's such a great time. And last year, that was where I saw both La La Land and Moonlight. Wow. And I remember seeing both those directors, you know, in the streets chatting, and they were really great friends, which of course came around the circle when it came to the
sure
Oscars.
Did.
And then at the Telluride Film Festival, they've announced their slate and they just announced their schedule. So I've been going through it and trying to figure out how it's possible to see everything, which of course everything clashes with everything else.
Of course, it's
always running around, like, how can I run from there to there and make the screenings? But I love these film festivals. I love going and seeing five films a day. It's such a treat for me and for all film fans. I'm so lucky that I get to do it as
High
part
five.
Of my job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so at TIFF, I'm really looking forward to seeing Mother, the Darren Aronofsky film, which we don't know a whole lot about. It's a psychological horror with Jennifer Lawrence. I'm excited for The Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro's film, Downsizing, Alexander Payne's movie. That looks good. I'm intrigued by Suburbicon, which is George Clooney's film, written also by Coen Brothers. And then Brie Larson has her film there, The Unicorn Store, which I've heard really good things about from someone who's gotten a sneak peek of it. And Greta Gerwig has also got her directorial debut called Lady Bird.
Awesome.
And her having worked with such great directors like
Noah Baumbach. Completely qualified, yeah.
Completely qualified, and so intrigued to see how she infuses their style maybe with her own, or what her vision's going to be. So cannot wait.
Yeah, awesome. Well, have a great time. I'll follow it on social media.
I'll be tweeting.
I bet. So my piece of flair is a little more film geeky. Well, that's very film geeky. Mine is more home media film geeky. There were a bunch of Region B box sets that were announced. So there was Louis Buñuel, Jean-Pierre Melville, and Aki Kaurismäki. So I don't know if you – are you a fan of Aki Kaurismäki or –
Yes, definitely. Great. And Louis Buñuel as well.
Me too, yeah. So it's tough because a lot of these overlap with Criterion. But they're such great films, and they're all restorations. I don't know. I haven't decided if I'm going to buy these yet, but I figured it's worth pointing out to people that these exist, and they look like tremendous sets. So I'll put links in for people that are interested.
So do you collect both the Criterion stuff and then non-Criterion?
I do. I have a lot. I have all the Blu-ray Criterions, and then way out of my bank account, and I buy the Region Bs that are really special, like Napoleon. I buy quite a few,
That's great.
Yeah, I love
them. So how many DVDs do you think you have in your collection?
Oh, yeah. I'm embarrassed to say, but about 1,500 to 2,000.
Ah, that's so cool. I know. That's so cool. I want to see them displayed. That's amazing.
Working on that. That's a big endeavor to get them all.
Do your own closet videos where people come over and just look at all your films.
That's an idea. come on. Yeah. Next time you're in town. No, I'm kidding. So where can people find you online? I know it's a lot of places. So I know Twitter is probably the easiest.
Yeah, Twitter's probably the easiest because there I make sure I tweet out all the things that I'm doing, all the videos I've done. So if you go to Twitter and I'm at Alicia Malone, AliciaMalone. And from there you can see everything I'm up to. And yeah, if you want to hear my thoughts on all the films that I'll be seeing at Telluride in Toronto, that's where I'll be posting.
Sweet. And you have a website too and a Facebook.
Yeah, so, AliciaMalone.com is my website. I've got Facebook and YouTube, which are both movies on my jam.
YouTube is a pretty big deal.
And then Instagram is just Alicia Malone as well.
Oh, that's right. Movies Are My Jam is your Facebook, right?
So yes.
Well, I'm Twitter, AWES505. I don't tweet as much as Alicia, but I wouldn't say it's time. Yeah, I don't know. I should tweet more. And then you can find us at Criterion Cast, Criterion Cast Master Feed for the podcast, or Criterion Now, however you're listening to it right now. The show is mainly in the Criterion Now Facebook group. So, Alicia, glad to have you. I'm actually a little starstruck.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel the same because I've listened to you for so long on your podcast. It's amazing to see your face. I'm like, oh, there you are.
That's me. So there you are. Well, have fun in Telluride. Is that how you say it?
Telluride. Yep.
And TIFF. So I look forward to seeing you there and Filmstruck. So
thanks, Aaron.